Dear Dhamma friend, so probably you can remember we are discussing Kakkavisana Sutta. Kakkavisana Sutta is available in Suttanipata, which is one of the interesting suttas. And Suttanipata itself is a very interesting book, which is believed quite relevant with the Buddha's early teachings. And very interesting suttas like Mangala Sutta, Ratana Sutta, then say Karaniya Metta Sutta. So many interesting suttas that we are quite familiar with are available in the Suttanipata. And this Kaggavisana Sutta also available in Suttanipata. And it's particularly emphasized the secluded practice and the value of practice in a way. And particularly each and every verse appearing in this Kaggavisana Sutta is attributed to the private Buddhas or the Paccheka Buddhas who are more intended on kind of secluded living. Now different types of Buddhas are recognized, explained. One is the Sammasambuddha who self-enlightened and able to explain Dhamma in detail. So there are many followers and he established the sasana as Sangha members. There are four lay people as well as the ordained monks and nuns are become more in the Sammasambuddha's that dispensation. And next is the Paccheka Buddha who also self-enlightened, but he doesn't have the skill or capacity to explain Dhamma as to the level of Sammasambuddha. Therefore, there is no such many followers or establishment of a sasana. So this is called the Paccheka Buddha. Then there are the other arahants. So they are also can be considered as fully enlightened beings. Actually, they need some amount of support coming from a Sammasambuddha. And then due to that guidance, so they also become enlightened. So they are the arahants or the enlightened beings. So different kinds of enlightenments or the different individuals, therefore we can recognize. Now this sutta particularly attributed as I mentioned to the Paccheka Buddhas, and due to various reasons, they leave their lay life and they start to practice Dhamma. And then they become Paccheka Buddhas. Now, today's verse also explain such a Paccheka Buddha. So, before he becomes a Paccheka Buddha, he was a king. But this king was not very powerful king, but in a very small country. But he is a very wise king, even though he had a small country to rule, and again he had only a limited number of army. He's a quite a wise person. So one day a thought come to him, even though I am a kind of a king to a small kingdom, I am a wise person, so let me invade another country. So this a kind of a thought came to his mind. And then he actually wanted to verify his thought, and he summoned his ministers and he explained his idea. And actually before he explained it, he sent a message to the neighboring country, to the king of the neighboring country, telling that I am going to invade your country. Either you give up your country and surrender to me, or else I am going to have a battle with you. So this is a message that he has sent to the neighboring country king. And after he sent the message, what happened is that he explained this situation to the ministers. But the ministers were so not confident about the king. So they said that you have done an inappropriate work, inappropriate task. You can't fight with these people. So better kill ourselves, commit suicide, rather than getting killed by these enemies. So they all want to kill themselves rather than going for fight. in a way they are not courageous. And then king summoned the army. According to the story, he had 1,000 warriors, and he explained the situation to those 1,000 warriors, and he mentioned that I have sent a message to the neighboring king telling that I am coming to the war, so you have to give up your kingdom, otherwise I am coming to the war. I have already sent the message. So once I explained the situation to the ministers, they are telling it is better to commit suicide rather than going to the war. So now I am going to commit suicide. What are you going to do? Are you also coming to commit suicide with me? Or what else are you going to do? So he is explaining the situation to the warriors. Then among these 1,000 warriors, 500 of them mentioned to the king, okay, the great king, we are also committing suicide. Then another 500 are telling, great king, I am committing suicide is very much like a woman's activity. I mean, we are warriors. We should go for the war. We should give a fight. It's better to die in the war field rather than committing suicide. Let's go for the war. Now, they are quite real warriors, and therefore they are quite confident that even though they are a small army, they are quite confident. They have a lot of self-confidence. They are quite courageous. So they are explaining that situation to the king. Then king was quite happy, and king took their side. Rather than committing suicide and rather than behaving like a weak person, he is becoming now stronger, mentally quite stronger, and he is now confident that he has at least 500 warriors who are ready to fight. And he was able to convince the other 500 warriors as well. Now they have 1,000 warriors. Since they know in terms of the capacity they are little, so they now want to use the brain. Now they want to use various tactics. And they want to use the intelligence to win the battle. Rather than simply using the number of armies, weapons and etc., they are now want to defeat the enemy using their wisdom, using their, say, intellect. What they did was secretly go closer to the enemy kingdom, and they were able to capture the enemy kingdom, enemy king. And once they are able to capture the enemy king, now this particular king asking, are you going to die or are you going to surrender? Now the king was captured, and this wise king is asking from the enemy king, are you going to die or are you going to surrender? Then the enemy king said, okay, I am going to surrender. Now this wise king is saying, okay, now I am forgiving you. So you have to come to my side. So let's rule both countries. And now they agreed on that occasion. And in the same way, so he is able to capture another country. So likewise, he is able to capture the whole India, according to this story. Now he has become the great king. Now after he becoming the great king, now he was thinking, now this war and these strategies, all this effort, I have used for some sort of a mundane task. Even though it appear like a great thing, but what I have achieved is a kind of a mundane task. Winning through the battle, defeating other people. It is true that now I am a great king. All the effort have been used. But this is still kind of a mundane thing, because he is a wise person, so he is now thinking differently. How about defeating oneself? How about defeating various defilements? So this is another way of thinking that the king is now having. Now he wants to defeat various defilements. What are the inner enemies? Time to time come and bother us. Time to time come and do various kind of inflictions, burn ourselves, And those inner enemies are the real enemies. Now the king want to battle against them, want to eradicate them. So now what he thought, let me give up the whole kingdom and let me go for this inner battle. So he did the same thing. So he has given up the kingdom and he became a monk, and he is firm in determination. He is quite courageous. He is with lot of energy, lot of effort. And due to his these kind of strengths, so he was able to even uproot various defilements and was able to become a Paccheka Buddha. Now after becoming a Paccheka Buddha, he is making a joyful utterance, and that is this verse. Araddha viriyo paramattha pattiya alina citto akusita vutti dalha nikkamo thama balupa panno eko chare kagga visana kappo. So each and every word is emphasizing on effort. Araddha viriyo, so one is with kind of a initial energy, initial effort. One needs some sort of an initiation. In order to do a task, you need this kind of an initiative effort. You need to start the work. You need to start the task. The task may appear quite difficult, but you need to start it. So this is the initial effort. Araddha viriyo paramattha pattiya. So in order to attain the supreme goal, now he is not talking about the mundane type of goal, but in order to achieve the supreme goal, that is the attainment of the Nibbana. So in order to attain Nibbana, so now I have to arouse energy. Alina citto akusita vutti. And now being unsluggish and robust practice. Now he has to continue his practice. He has to have a strong practice, dedicated practice. And with unsluggish mind, mind can't go down and mind can't sort of become lethargic. Mind can't be sluggish. Dalha nikkamo, firmly persistent. There are obstacles coming and you have to have kind of a persistent practice, not to give up. Spiritual practice is not something, a kind of an easy thing, because defilement power is so powerful. And that sometimes drag ourselves again and again, pull ourselves back to the sort of defiled situations. On such occasions, we have to have a strong effort. Dalha nikkamo, firmly persistent, not to give up. Thama balupa pannu, equipped with strength and power. Now here, not only the mental effort, even the bodily effort. One has to have a good healthy body in order to continue one's practice. Eko chare kagga visana kappu. Having all these different kinds of efforts, one is living alone like a rhinoceros horn. So this is the kind of a short explanation about this verse. And particularly this verse is explaining about the effort. So as I mentioned, different levels or different types of effort are explained in Dhamma. One is called Arambha Dhatu, the initial effort. Then the Nikkama Dhatu, kind of the intermediate or the sustained effort. Then Parakrama Dhatu, the superior kind of energy that you need to fulfill, you need to complete, you need to come for the perfection. So that is the superior kind of an effort. So these three levels, different three categories of effort are being explained in Dhamma. Because you can understand, I mean, all these three types of efforts are needed. I mean, without starting a particular task, a difficult task, you can't sustain it. You need to first start. So in order to start, you need an effort. So that is typically called as Arambha Dhatu Virya. And sometimes what happens is, even though people start, they are not continuing. In between, they give up. They may go through certain difficult situations, certain obstacles come their way. So at that time, they don't have sustained effort. They are not persevering. So that is therefore required that you need to have kind of a persistent effort to overcome obstacles. That is the Nikkama Dhatu Viriya. And again, as you are going forward, probably there is a huge obstacle. So you need on such occasions a very firm determination. So that is the Parakkama Dhatu Viriya, where you are now ready even to give up your life, go for battle or go for to completion of the task. So that is the great kind of an effort. Now, if we consider different types of effort explained in Dhamma, so we can come to different levels actually. Now, probably you have heard about 37 Bodhipakkhiya Dhammas, where Buddha explains the development of various spiritual qualities. Now, first four are the four Satipatthanas, and then one has four great efforts, Sammapradhana, and then four Iddipadas, and then one has spiritual faculties, Indriya, then one has the Bala, powers, then seven enlightened factors, and then the Noble Eightfold Path. So likewise, kind of a categorization has happened as the Buddha's teaching evolves, and therefore the effort is not kind of a constant kind of a quality. Rather, as we are moving forward, effort is also evolving. So at the beginning, what you have is one type of effort, and later it is maturing, it is further enhancing, spreading, it is becoming more seasoned, more settled. So likewise, different facets of effort can be recognized. Now, say for example, you are practicing walking meditation. So at that time also you need fair amount of effort, because walking meditation, you have to keep your eyes open and so many distractions might happen. So at that time, again and again, you have to bring your mind back to the posture, the walking posture, the movement or the touching sensation. So this requires fair amount of effort not to give up. And again, sometimes we are using what you call labeling or noting. So when your left foot is touching, so we are making a simple label as left. When your foot is, right foot is touching the ground, you are making a small label called right. So this is also a little effort. And it is kind of an effort that confirmation that certain physical activity has happened, so you are acknowledging it. But later, as you are quite confident about the practice and you gain mindfulness, you don't need to maintain such kind of a labeling thing. You can simply discard labeling and you can maintain a very soft effort. Now you don't need to have a confirming kind of effort, but you can have a soft ongoing practice. There are no need to label, you have no need to note, rather you are making, you are aware of the task, you are aware of the lifting of the leg, aware of the moving of the leg, aware of the placing of the leg. So likewise, kind of an evolution happens here as well. That is at the Satipatthana level. And when it comes to striving, Sammapradhana, so four types of striving Buddha mentioned. Actually, first we need to have kind of a striving to restrain ourselves, because assume that your mind is now free from various defilements. So we need to have kind of a restrainment not to encourage defilements, not to arouse defilements, not to pollute the mind. Because already mind is somewhat pure, not to invite and pollute the mind. So that requires certain amount of restrainment, Sangvarapradhana. And so you need, if there are no defilements, so you have to have kind of an effort not to arouse new defilements. So that is one type of effort. And then assume due to certain reason, say defilements have arisen. Now what to do? Now you need to let it go. You need to leave it, not to encourage it. So that is actually the pahanappadhana, where you are removing it. You need some amount of effort to that. And assume that you need to arouse certain good qualities. You need to develop good qualities that also require some amount of energy. And then once you develop, that is called bhavanapadhana, and once you are able to develop some good qualities, you need to protect it. Otherwise, it will slowly seep through. So you need to protect what you have developed. So that is called anurakkhanapadhana. So you are protecting what you already developed. So therefore, different levels of energy and different types of energy is explained in the sammapadhana. And then virya iddipada. So you are having spiritual power. So you are having effort as the main theme, because different people have different spiritual powers, we can say. So some are more in determination. So I need to fulfill this. So here they are quite determined to do it. Or certain others have a lot of energy. So they are energy character. Very much like effortful, not to give up. So that is more the energy task, energy's characteristics, so which actually we are discussing today. And certain others are more intellectual. I mean, they are wise. So they want to explore what is really happening. They want to explore. So, and some are actually have a kind of a desire to do something. Chanda. So desire is there. Chanda, virya, chitta, vimansa. So these are the four kind of iddipadas Buddha mentioned. So in the virya iddipada. So when one has effort as the more governing factor in one's practice, so that is also available. So virya iddipada. And as one is developing one's practice, so you are coming to a level where different spiritual qualities become available to you, and you are now slowly aware of their presence. Say, for example, at the beginning you don't know much about mindfulness. You have heard but never practiced. Suppose now you are putting some effort and you are now practicing. So at the beginning you are able to keep your attention only on 10 breaths. Most of the time mind gets distracted. Not to give up, again and again practice, okay, after some time you are able to maintain your attention on 20 breaths. And after some time, you are able to pay attention on 30 breaths. So likewise, you are improving. So now, after say several weeks of practice, several months of practice, now you become confident, okay, when I sit, I am able to maintain my attention on breathing. And continuously, I can maintain this focused attention on breathing. So the presence of mind or the mindfulness, therefore, is a kind of a quality now you are able to recognize. So you know when you are mindful. You know when you are not mindful. So the presence of mindfulness is something that you can notice. Similarly, you can practice, say, saddha. You can, that is the, what you call the faith. And similarly, you can recognize effort. Say when mind goes down, you are able to pull it up. You are able to lift it up. So that is the effort, task of effort. So when mind is quite energetic, you can recognize it. And when your mind is well concentrated, you can recognize it. When the concentration or samadhi is present. And when mind is having a penetrative understanding, that is wisdom, panya, you can recognize. So likewise, as we are moving forward, so these faculties, indriya, become evident to us. So time to time, one of them may be leading the role, leading the main role. And on this, actually, virya indriya explains that the presence of virya, presence of effort. And you can distinctly recognize, okay, now today my mind is quite energetic. I can do whatever the thing that I want. So you have that confidence, quite energetic. So that is the virya indriya. The next level is more kind of a mature level, Even when mind feel a little lethargic, you are not much worried about it because you know I can quickly handle it. I can quickly arouse energy. Then this lethargic, lazy feeling will go away. So you are not much worried about these certain glitches happening in your practice because you are now getting more confident. You are becoming a kind of a seasoned practitioner. Or you are becoming a more mature practitioner. You are now with a lot of hands-on experience. So you know how to handle situation. Even when things are sort of going down, you know how to bring it up. So now you are maturing. So that is called the virya bala. So even when mind becomes sluggish, you are not much worried about it because you know how to remove sluggishness. You know how to remove laziness. Again, arouse energy. So that is called virya bala. And next level is virya sambojjhanga, where you are able to recognize the presence of effort. And now actually the effort is more aimed towards achieving nibbana. Not much onto the other achievements. Actually, in the spiritual development, all these qualities you can even use in the typical mundane activities. But when you are moving forward, actually, especially when you are reaching to the level of the enlightened factors, now the mind is more inclined towards attaining Nibbana, maintaining the peace of mind, removing defilements, and having a non-grasping mind, unwind, sort of unbounded mind, a kind of a freedom. So the orientation has more focused. So you are now, so you are not doing the practice for the sake of, say, popularity or gaining something or becoming a famous person or something like that. But rather you are kind of doing as a kind of a spiritual exploration to recognize various defilements to become a good human being. To experience inner clarity or inner peace or extinguishment, extinction of various defilements. So likewise, the more focus is now moving towards the eradication of defilements and overcoming defilements, having a very peaceful mind, pure mind. So that is the enlightenment factor of virya. And sammavayama, that is the last level, what we can call, where the right effort. It is not working alone, but it is getting the help of samma sati and samma ditti. So the right view and right mindfulness go hand in hand with the sammavayama, right effort. So now they are working as three friends, as a group. And again, when we are discussing these things, we can recognize balancing of effort. Say, we have to balance faith with wisdom. So if you don't have wisdom, so if you have only faith, so it may go to certain some foolish activities and not using proper, say, understanding. But on the other hand, if you don't have faith at all, only the kind of the wisdom, maybe the intellectual capacity, then you are very much kind of opportunistic or kind of a cunning type of person because you don't have faith. So therefore, kind of a balance is required between the faith and the wisdom. On the other hand, as we are moving forward, so the effort and the concentration has to be well balanced. So this balancing has to happen on the way. That means while you are practicing, say for example, when you are sitting, you need to have a fair amount of effort because you need to overcome various hindrances. But when mind settles, when you are able to restrain various hindrances, now you don't need to apply that much of effort. If you are applying excess effort, then that excessive effort itself can become a hindrance. So therefore, you need to recognize where you are, how mind is behaving. Is it slowly growing? Is it properly concentrated now? And all the hindrances are subsided. So you need to recognize that. So once you are able to recognize that, now you can slowly reduce the effort, and you can simply maintain only the necessary amount of effort or the optimal effort. On that situation, then the samadhi concentration has the opportunity to come up. So therefore, this balancing has to happen on the way during your practice. So the monitoring part is done by the mindfulness. And actually, the balancing of enlightenment factors is also another topic Buddha explained. When we consider enlightenment factors, Buddha mentioned that they belong to kind of three groups. One group is more energetic, more active. Another group is more into the kind of calming down, making the mind peaceful. So investigation, Dhamma Vichaya, effort, Virya, rapture, Piti. So this is the group more energetic. On the other hand, tranquility, concentration and equanimity. So they are more into the calming down. So when calming down is too much, mind can become sluggish. And when the active part is too much, mind can become restless. So these two sides has to be properly balanced. So who is showing, who is telling us which part is more active or which group is too active or excess? So that is the task of mindfulness. So mindfulness has to be present every time so that we are being informed, okay, the active part is too much, or okay, the sluggish part or the calming side is too much. Now it is about to sleep, about to going for drowsiness. So you have to now activate the mind. So if it is too much activate or too much active, then it's about to become restless. Now you need to calm down. So likewise, this observation is happened through the mindfulness. So you can see in the spiritual practice, so these different teachings have very, very good practical value. So you need to use these teachings for the development of your spiritual faculties. And when you are in the real practice, probably you can remember these teachings, how Buddha has explained. So these different kinds of effort, the evolution of effort, or the balancing of effort. So when I have to balance effort, so that you need to explore. Experientially, you need to understand that. So therefore, this verse actually explained certain aspects of the virya. And as I mentioned, so virya or the effort is something that we need to have throughout our practice. What I mean is that it is not kind of a 100-meter race, but rather it is a marathon kind of a race. So you need to have a kind of an effort, a perseverant kind of an effort. Maintain it for a long time, lifelong time effort. So not to give up. Even when certain obstacles are coming on your way, not to give up. Using those obstacles to nourish yourself, to mature ourselves, to overcome those obstacles, and so that we become more stronger, able to sustain, able to endure things. Now, this is what I like to share with you today. And now I like to open the session for questions.
After I submit an answer, James Chappell is getting a little late joining, so I will start reading the question.
Can you make yourself louder, Chamila? I can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Chatur is getting a little late coming today, so I will start reading the questions. Yes, so we have four questions now. First one is mindful sitting. Dear Bhante, much merits for explaining the nature of sound of silence last time. Similar to the participant who raised this question, I also started hearing this high-frequency pitch, bell-like sound, once the mind settles during the sitting practice. My sitting practice is being mindful on the breath, and I was fortunate to get some time to practice regularly and connect with this program to clear my doubts. During most of the sitting sessions, the breath fades away within 10 to 15 minutes, and I enter into spacious, empty space. During the rest of the session, time is spent observing various sensations and thoughts. Then I start hearing sound of silence. If I focus observing a sound observation, this becomes very prominent when the sound ceases and the sound of silence continues. It was possible to be mindful on sound of silence, but as Bhante mentioned, not as an object of observation. How much I observe and concentrate with sound of silence, there seems to be no start and end to it, or rising and falling of it, like the thoughts, sound, and every other sensation. However, I could be mindful on sound of silence dropping everything else, which makes the sound very loud and filling up all the whole space without any stress or irritation. The other observation I have is that it is possible to send sound of silence to background and observe other objects while listening to it. I could listen to sounds, observe some posture-related pain, starting and fading away of breath in the backdrop of sound of silence. Presume I can use it as a backdrop of observation similar to the spacious space. These are my observations and much merits again for your valuable guidance. With metta, that's the end of the question.
Yeah, thank you for sharing your observations, and this is exactly we want to understand. So sound of silence may appear like a backdrop or like a background, and we don't need to use it as an object of our practice. So it is there. So it indicates that we are now well grounded and mind is ready to further observation of various other phenomena. As you have mentioned, the sound of silence appear like the background. In that background, there is a thought arise. In that background, there is a pain arise. In that background, different kind of a feeling arise. In that background, there is a sensation arise. So this sensation is object of our meditation. This feeling is object of our meditation. This thought is object of our meditation. And simply the sound of silence remain. It may be there. And we don't need to do a lot of investigations on sound of silence. I mean, it is there. But I mean, you can enjoy it if you like. But I mean, spending time exploring different aspects of sound of silence is also not necessary, because it is there. And actually, as we move forward, it may go or fade away, and it becomes more kind of a silent. Now there is no sound. It is kind of a silent only. So therefore, this is something that happens internally. I don't know exactly what is the kind of biological reason for this. But anyway, as we move forward, so this is a kind of a evolution happens to this sound of silence as well. So sometimes when mind attunes to a particular frequency, the sound of silence become available. When that frequency become different, then sound of silence is not available. So you can recognize various other phenomena. Therefore, this is the typical information available about sound of silence. And Ajahn Sumedho is one of the teachers explained sound of silence in detail. And again, Ajahn Amaro has published a book, I think Inner Sound or something, I can't exactly remember. You can actually explore it from the Amaravati monastery website. So this is actually have translated that Rani Rajapaksha, who is one of our devotees, who has translated that into Sinhala as well. That is called Atulatata Savandima, available in Nisarvana website. If you like, you can search for that book. That is the translation of Ajahn Amaro's book. And therefore, these are kind of interesting phenomena available in our practice. And the presence of sound of silence, so when you are attuned to sound of silence, you can understand, okay, now mind is settled. Inner chatter has fairly calmed down. I was able to plug into the sound of silence. I was able to properly tune into sound of silence. So that indicates mind has some clarity. Mind has some calmness. So it's indicates some improvement in our practice. Yeah.
I'm sorry, Bhante. Question number 2 of 4. This is a general question. Dear Bhante, thank you for organizing and inviting us to the wonderful felicitation program of Most Venerable Dhammadeva Thera yesterday. You have given a good theoretical and detailed outline of our practice, which I've heard for the first time. Much merits. In one of the panel discussions, there was an introduction to the Lung Po Tian method of Thailand. The walking practice seems similar to what we do, but sitting is different. Can Bhante explain a bit around how the hand movements in this practice can lead to mindfulness practice, if you understood the details? With metta, that's the end of the question.
Yeah, so actually now, say for example, while walking, we do purposeful walking. So each and every movement of the leg is something that we are observing. Now, since we are doing it for long time, so we don't need to much think about walking or intentional about walking. It happens naturally because we were walking from our childhood. But actually, when we consider the task, so there are a lot of detail around it. So there is a little intention, and there is a lifting of the leg. There is another intention. There is the movement of the leg. There's another intention. There's a placing of the leg. And then there is a touching sensations. So likewise, we can analyze this whole walking in terms of how many activities are involved, subtle activities are involved. Now the same thing applies to Luang Po Tien method. So instead of considering this sitting, rather the walking, now you can see that you do some kind of purposeful movements to your hands. So you are lifting and then turning it and then placing it on your knee, again lifting the other arm, turning it, keeping it on your knee. So likewise, some intentional movements are done on the hands. Now, as you are becoming more familiar with it, so these intentional movements you can recognize. So this is all kaya anupassana. So certain bodily movements are happening and there is a certain intention involved, and as you are improving in the mindfulness, you can recognize this intention. You can recognize each and every bodily movement. And only at the beginning, you feel it as a compact movement. But when our clear comprehension, clear knowing improves, this compactness breaks and you can recognize more subtle information. Like exactly like walking. At the beginning, you are simply noting it as left, right, left, right. But later, you don't need to do left, right. Rather, you are observing with silent mind. Lifting, moving, placing, the whole process you can observe silently. And as furthering your practice, lifting is not a single activity. It may consist of thousands of little movements. Moving is not a single activity. It consists of so many movements. Placing is not a single activity. It consists of so many subtle activities. So likewise, your resolution or your say precision of your practice improves, and therefore this each and every momentary experience you are able to recognize in walking. So the same scenario happens in the Luang Tien method as I understood it, and actually I watched a couple of videos when Balachara Thero, and when he was explaining it, and I have seen several videos available in the internet. And instead of walking, they do, I mean, if we apply the same theory, what I have explained to this hand movements, so that same resolution as we improve, comprehension as we improve, so the little information, very subtle aspects of these movements going to be available. And they are arising and passing away and become apparent, so the insight knowledges may be available. So likewise, these kaya anupassana techniques, though they appear different from outset, from their overview, from their appearance, but when you are going forward, moving forward, and as you are improving further and further, so the essence become more common. So therefore I feel that this would be a kind of a useful method for people who can't walk, because I come across certain situations that some people are explaining, Bante, I went through a surgery, so I can't walk now. How I can practice walking meditation? I have arthritis, now I can't walk. How am I going to practice walking meditation? So if you can't walk, actually you can do this kind of a practice where you are doing kind of intentional movements of your arms and you are maintaining some kind of systematic approach to that, like Luang Po Tien method. And now you do proper movements of your hands, and then as you improve, you can get a lot of mindfulness. You can get a lot of clear comprehension. It leads to understanding. It leads to the availability of various insights. And then it actually can connect with the mindfulness of the mind, the Chittanupassana, Dhammanupassana, etc. So the Satipatthana is available there. So therefore, I feel it is kind of a useful method that one can practice if you are interested. I mean, particularly when you can't walk, you are interested of the hand movements, and you can use these hand movements to energize or improve mindfulness and clear comprehension. Yeah.
Question number 3 of 5. This is a general question. Dear Venerable Swami Vansa, much merits if you can explain what is Yugananda practice. Does that make sense, that word?
Yugananda.
Yes, I think
Yugananda.
So.
Yugananda, yeah.
Yeah, from the literal meaning, we have heard that it is starting with samatha practice and changing to vipassana at some point. Appreciate if Bhante can explain how this is practically done using anapanasati practice. Is there a sutta which details this practice? With metta, that's the end of the question.
Actually, 4 types of meditation techniques are explained in books. One is the samatha-oriented vipassana, samatha pubbangama vipassana, where you start with the tranquility and then move to vipassana. Then vipassana pubbangama samatha, start with vipassana, and then if you like, you can switch to samatha as well. So you can go for a certain amount of tranquility practice. Then this yugananda practice, where you are maintaining some parallel development of the tranquility and the vipassana. So that is the yugananda. And the 4th one is called dhamma uddaccha vigrahita manasa, where some sort of restlessness happens in the mind because of too much knowledge about the dhamma, knowledge about the information about the dhamma on such situation, how to handle it. And that is another method explained. Now, yugananda practice is actually, as I mentioned, you are giving some time to develop tranquility, samatha, and you are giving some time to practice vipassana. So it is going hand in hand. Both are maintained. So this is also a very valid practice. So because when your mind doesn't have enough concentration, you can't see phenomena clearly. So actually in the vipassana practice, in one stage, you need to clearly know different phenomena. Say you are observing various feelings. So if you don't have enough concentration, you can't recognize various feelings. So you have very much like a unfocused mind. Then you can't distinctly recognize various feelings. So you need a fair amount of concentration in order to recognize these feelings. So the concentration become kind of a prerequisite. And assume now you have concentration. And now you are observing various feelings. And when you do this observation, probably again mind can become restless. So again mind can become scattered, unfocused. Now you need to again redevelop concentration. So this is going hand in hand. So actually Buddha's teaching requires, or Buddha explains, this samatha and vipassana are kind of two requisites or two skills that we need to develop. So probably you can remember Anuggahita Sutta, where Buddha explains about 5 supports. Sutame Jnana, Sutta Anuggahita, the knowledge that we gain through the Buddha's teaching by listening to his Dhamma, to going through his teachings, reading books. So this is the Sutta Anugahita, learning through learning. Then you have the Sakaccha Anugahita. We do some going through some discussions so that our various doubts can be eliminated. So there are the discussions are kind of a support. Sakaccha Anugahita. Actually, the Sila Anugahita. Then you are maintaining fair amount of good morality, good virtues. So that is the Sila Anugahita. So you need that support. Then Buddha talks about Samatha Anugahita and the Vipassana Anugahita. So you can see Samatha and Vipassana Buddha recommended. So some amount of concentration is necessary. Samatha is required. Then Vipassana is also required. So therefore Yoganadha practice is therefore something very useful. Time to time you need to observe the level of concentration what I have. Is it enough? So if it is not enough, now you better develop some amount of some of the practice. You do a little bit of concentration practice. Okay, Anapanasati. You are developing, you are keeping your attention on the breath, trying to recognize whether it is longer, shorter, etc. So your focused attention become more precise. So you are able to properly aim your mind, properly focus your mind. So the concentration is developed. And when that is available, okay, now you can focus your attention to a feeling, to a thought, and therefore you can understand how they are behaving. So you are doing the insight practice, Vipassana practice. So this Yoganadha is therefore very interesting and quite practical approach Buddha has explained.
Question number 4 of 5. This one is walking mindfulness. Dear Bhante, my question is observing thoughts while on walking practice. Thank you for your valuable guidance, and I managed to develop a practice during the last few years where I feel very calm and relaxed after a mindfulness session. The walking happens quite well with minimum inner chatter and most of the time effortlessly and automatic mode during a session. If there is not much distractions and mind comes back naturally after deviating from the walking process, is it the right time to watch the thoughts while walking? I appreciate if Bhante can explain this a bit and if there is a difference compared to sitting practice and watching the thoughts as highlighted in the guided practice today. That's the end of the question.
Yeah, actually, during the walking practice, if you are confident that I can immediately watch the thoughts, you can go for that. But if you feel that when you are trying to do that, still mind is continuing with too much thinking, overthinking, proliferation, so that indicates it's too early to watch the mind. So you better do walking meditation. Say you better focus your attention on say the movements and touching and etc. so that you are catching up the momentum. You are able to focus your attention on the sensations. You are developing mindfulness and clear comprehension. And when you have enough mindfulness and clear comprehension, now again you can try watching the mind. So the determining factor in that sense, we can say, is the availability of mindfulness and clear comprehension, sati sampajanya. When it is properly available, you can start watching the mind. And the success indicates that the thoughts appearing in the mind may not last for a long time because you are precisely looking at them. So this is what I like to tell you.
Question number 5, I think it's the last one, general question. Dear Bhante, regarding today's Dhamma talk, can you please explain a bit about the effort needed to balance faith and wisdom in a practical way? What are the traits of faith and wisdom which we can relate to our practice? That's the end of the question.
Yeah, actually I like to share now, say for example, when you go to a temple, so people are coming sometimes doing a lot of rituals and say they are offering food to the Buddha and they are what you call as Buddha Puja and they are offering various puja rituals to the Bodhi tree and they are offering various things to the pagoda. And so some people are not much thinking, and sometimes they are, say, burning candles or burning incense sticks and putting inside the shrine room. And sometimes if they are with too much faith, I have seen that they are putting Buddha puja even on the hand of the Buddha. Actually, you might have seen, say, Buddha statue is there, and certain devotees are coming and they are putting, say, lump of rice or whatever the food that they want to offer just on top of the hand of the Buddha, on the Buddha statue. So they don't understand. I mean, this is kind of, I am damaging the Buddha statue. I am making the whole shrine room a little smelly. And now someone else has to clean. So this is not the proper faith. So you are not having enough wisdom. So I'm offering some Buddha puja. Okay, I'm using the proper vessel, proper container. I have prepared it faithfully. And maybe there is a kind of a table prepared to keep the Buddha puja. And let me keep there. May pay respect to the Buddha. And later, after some time, okay, you collect it and throw it away. So this is where, I mean, we have a certain amount of wisdom coupled with the faith, and we know Buddha at this time, this is simply representing, this is a Buddha statue. I am offering Buddha puja as a kind of a gratitude to the Buddha. This Buddha statue is not going to consume what I am offering. So the merit is for me. I am having some generous feelings. I am developing certain amount of faith. And even when I am preparing the Buddha puja, I am having a lot of faith. So the merit is for me. The development of the faith is for me. And when I offer the Buddha puja, I am doing it fully faithfully, in a kind of a very innocent kind of a mindset. So this is quite helpful myself. So all offering of Buddha puja, therefore, is helpful to ourselves. But if we are not coupling it with the wisdom, then we are sometimes going too much, too far, and we damage even the Buddha statue, and we may burn a lot of candles, or we may burn a lot of incense sticks inside the shrine room, so others can't breathe even, and we may even quarrel who is going to take the first line of Buddha puja. Say you have different tables maintained, and you need to have the very closed table. So if you are not given that opportunity, you are quarreling with others. So this is actually not using the intellectual capacity, or this is not using the wisdom. So faith and wisdom therefore has to go hand in hand. So if you only have wisdom, then you are not sort of having enough emotional quotient. So you don't feel anything. You become somewhat callous about emotions. So you don't have any faith. That is also not good. So some people are like that. I mean, they never go to a temple. They never do a Buddha puja. So, I mean, when you offer Buddha puja, you become somewhat a kind of innocent person. You don't need to rigid yourself. You don't need to be a rough character. So we have learned a lot from the Buddha, even though he is not present now. So we are benefiting from his character, from his example, and we are benefiting a lot from his teaching. So when I have prepared something, assume that you have a garden, and you did a kind of a plowing, and you collected some amount of new fruits or new paddy or whatever it is. And as a faithful person, so you are offering the very first harvest to the Buddha. So it's a kind of a faith. So that is helpful in a way. So that helps the gratitude in yourself, the sensitivity in yourself, kind of the soft character in yourself. So the offering is also there, and maintaining the proper limits using the wisdom is also there.
I don't think there was any more questions. Let me just check. No, that was the last one. And I think we've just come to the end of the program anyway, so I'd like to finish up. First, I'd like to thank Bhante for passing on all this valuable advice and wisdom to us, and also to pass on any merits that we've generated together. And secondly, to the people seen and unseen working to help make this program a success. And also, lastly, to the participants, because without you, we could not continue. So with that, I'd like to end the program. Teruvan Sannai.
Yeah, Teruvan Sannai. Teruvan Sannai.